While counsel are getting ready, I will call the third case, the third and final case on today's oral argument calendar. It's case number A22-1214, State of Minnesota versus Olak Lero Olak. As counsel know, each of you have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. If you are ready, appellant's counsel, you may approach the lectern and please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument. I will note that the lectern it's adjustable. It's got an electric motor that there's a button on the front ledge that can, or a couple of buttons maybe that will raise it or lower it, so feel free to adjust it to your preference.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Baxter Ryan Zeiger, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Olak. Mr. Olak was convicted at jury trial of 2 counts of criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. He is now respectfully requesting this court reverse his conviction and order a new trial. The basis for this request is due to a structural error that affected the framework for how the trial proceeded. There are 3 issues that I want to go over. First is, was there an issue? Second is, was there an issue that was structural? And 3 is whether or not the forfeiture doctrine precludes appellate relief.
And just to be clear, if I may clarify from the outset, do you agree that the argument you're making on appeal was not preserved in the district court?
Your Honor, I am arguing that there was, I recognize that there was no objection at the district court with respect to this error.
So there was no argument. Okay, thank you.
Certainly. There was an error that occurred, and that error occurred when the cross-examination of the victim, SC, occurred after the state had rested its case, after the defense rested their case, and during the rebuttal portion of the trial. There are 2 sources for this, for the order of presentation of evidence that I rely on. First is Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 26.03, Subdivision 12, which states that the state's case in chief proceeds first, then followed by defense. The second source is the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which guarantees the right to be confronted with witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor. Boiling that down, the right to confrontation occurs prior to beginning one the ability to call one's own witnesses. When you bring that in conjunction with the purpose of cross-examination, which is to challenge the reliability of testimony from direct examination, it follows naturally that cross-examination occurs right after direct examination and certainly before the close of one's case in chief. Otherwise, we would be in a situation where the district court is bouncing around witnesses and there would be a substantial waste of judicial resources.
Mr. Zeiger or Zeiger?
Zeiger, Your Honor. Rhymes with tiger.
Thank you. So the rule of criminal procedure that you're citing, 2603, I think, sub 12, and I think you're looking at paragraph G, the first sentence states the general rule, and then the second sentence says, in the interest of justice, the court may allow any party to reopen that party's case to offer additional evidence. Does that second sentence apply here?
I don't believe it does because the cross-examination was not completed in the first case. What happened in Mr. Olak's case is a VR and SC testified. There was a disclosure of evidence that occurred after they had been excused as witnesses, although I do believe they were under subpoena. There was then a plan in place of how the defense was going to re-examine those witnesses. And what I'm arguing is that the state would have been allowed to recall those witnesses during their case in chief. But that didn't occur. The defense's essentially case in chief proceeded. And there's not a whole lot of propositions that I can point to other than Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure and the Sixth Amendment of the United States, but I cannot find a whole lot of case law, and in my experience as primarily a trial attorney, is that I haven't seen a case where this occurs, where certainly right after the state's case in chief, and then the defendant decides to testify, and then only after and only during the rebuttal portion of phrase of the trial can the defendants actually vindicate their full right to confrontation.
And just to be clear, I mean, trial counsel, were you trial counsel?
No. I was not.
Yeah. Trial counsel did as much cross-examination as he or she wished at the time, given what he or she knew about the state's evidence, And then really what counsel asked for later was an opportunity to conduct additional cross-examination based upon the untimely disclosed evidence, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And maybe it's a matter of characterization. I'm not sure if it's appropriate to say that defense counsel didn't complete cross-examination. That the completion of cross-examination was delayed or deferred until a later date. I mean, defense counsel did as much as defense counsel wanted, but then what was requested was an opportunity to cross-examine witnesses further.
Certainly, Your Honor, I would agree with that point. However, in this case, before the state rested, that's when the error occurred. During the state's case in chief, they uncovered this additional piece of evidence, disclosed it to the defense. They had an opportunity to review it, but the court decided and the parties decided as well that cross-examination was not going to be, I'm going to put in quotes, complete until during the rebuttal portion of the phase. So this entire issue could have been negated had the cross-examination occurred during the state's case in chief.
You mentioned, clearly your argument has been, this is structural error. But this right to confrontation argument specifically, I don't see that in your brief.
I did cite Crawford for the proposition of cross-examination follows direct examination. I don't know the extent that I cite the confrontation clause other than that. The next issue I want to go over is whether or not this error was structural in nature. First, there's essentially two elements. One, was there an error that affected the framework of how the trial proceeded? And number two is, does the error call into question the reliability and fairness of the trial? I kind of already went over how this error did affect the framework of the trial because cross-examination occurred after the defendant's case in chief and during the rebuttal phase of the trial. But when you look at this in the negative, that is, the order doesn't matter, cross-examination can be completed at any point throughout the case, illuminates the fundamental unfairness. First, let's take this example. The state calls a witness, and that witness testifies to all the essential elements. The defendant is prohibited from cross-examining them until after their case in chief. State then rests. The defendant would then have to make an impossible decision. Are they going to testify, or do they not testify? And that's what boils down to Mr. Bullock's case. Excuse me one second. Mr. Olak and defendants in this situation would never be able to fully make a knowing and intelligent waiver of the right to remain silent because they don't have the entire state's case. They don't know what fully is they're up against. While I do recognize that the discovery occurred, cross-examination occurred later after Mr. Olak testified, he was not fully prepared to waive his right to remain silent or to testify because he had no idea what was going to be testified to by SC. And that would affect every single defendant if order did not matter. There.
This case, I'm a little troubled by that because, his whole argument was this didn't happen. So, his was their line, this is not what happened, and then this video is of this SC, in theory, racing naked to a neighbor's apartment. And that neighbor talked about the bruising, so... I don't know. Once the cross-examination did occur, it was a series of like two or three questions, and it didn't even address anything that seemed to be relevant to the defendant's theory of the case. So I'm struggling here with how this was structural error.
Your Honor, that's a good point, and I was going to get to that. There's three circumstances in which errors can be deemed structural. One is which the harm is irrelevant. So it doesn't matter necessarily what was going to happen on cross-examination of SC. In other words, the structural right that was violated, i.e., the order of presentation of evidence, exists to protect something other than the fairness of the final verdict, i.e., what she said on cross-examination may not have mattered. Order of examination...
What she said, it was what she was asked.
What she was asked, what she testified to, I'll agree to that. What matters is that right, the order of presentation of evidence, was designed to protect something other than the final verdict. That is, it was designed to protect defendants. Defendants, and I kind of touched on this earlier about the right to remain silent, defendants' rights are violated when they cannot make a knowing and intelligent waiver of their right to remain silent. So in this case, I agree with you, Miss, the testimony and the questions asked during the rebuttal portion of the phase It was only a couple questions. I completely agree with that.
When did you see the video and who showed it to you? I mean, that's...
Showed it to me?
No, that's what she was asked.
Correct.
By defense counsel.
Correct. And but harm is irrelevant. So it doesn't necessarily matter what the questions were. It matters what can happen if order does not matter.
So to that point, I think the Supreme Court has stated that structural errors are those in which the entire conduct of the trial from the beginning to the end is obviously affected.
Correct.
And it's not clear to me how the, you know, very limited situation that we have here infected the entire trial from the beginning to the end.
And that's because Mr. Olak was not able to fully get a sense of what the state's case in chief was, what the evidence was against him before he decided whether or not he was going to testify. He couldn't make a knowing and intelligent waiver because he didn't know what was going to happen. Certainly, there was only a couple questions asked of SC that could have changed. We'll never know. And the other circumstance in which there's been structural errors when the effect of the error is hard to measure. That's where we are, and that's why I'm hinging our argument on structural error, not necessarily plain error. It's impossible to assess the impact that delayed cross-examination had on the trial. Would the defendant have testified? Would the defense attorney have asked other questions? Would there have been other motions that would have been raised prior to Mr. Olak testifying? We'll never know. And I agree that once there's a structural error, it's such a grave error that it's automatically presumed that we're going to reverse the conviction, order a new trial. That's what's happening here. Under those three circumstances, when the effect of the error cannot be assessed, harm is irrelevant. And the third, and harm is irrelevant, not putting those together. The second circumstance is when the claimed error always results in fundamental unfairness. So when you look at the line of cases that I cited, I think it was Bay, Everson, everything in there that talks about these three set of circumstances, you don't necessarily look at what happened to this specific defendant. You ask yourself, what could happen? What could happen to other defendants if order does not matter? And that's why I think it's important to look at this case and look at the proposition that cross-examination can... It doesn't matter. It doesn't need to occur during the state's case. It can happen during a rebuttal. That in and of itself, as a defense attorney and for clients charged with crimes, would be nearly impossible to decide what are we going to do on defense, because we haven't had an opportunity to cross-examine, and the purpose of cross-examination has not been vindicated under Crawford.
But, you know, you're speaking broadly, and I can see this being a much stronger case had there been no cross-examination, but, you know, they had cross-examination of SC and VR, I believe, as the other victim. And then this appearance of the videotape. So, everyone's trying to deal with this unexpected development, basically, because the tape is now available and had been thought previously to be lost. So it wasn't a circumstance where there was no cross until the defendant testified. So, you know, back to what Judge Cochran was saying, it seems like we're dealing with a very isolated circumstance in response to something that occurred mid-trial, which is, you know, not uncommon. And the court and the parties trying to grapple with that.
Absolutely. And that's perhaps why I had troubles finding sources for the proposition that cross-examination follows directly after direct examination. I agree. I've never seen this, and I don't think in any of the Court of Appeals decisions or Supreme Court decisions that I've seen will have the same set of facts. But it doesn't necessarily matter that... sorry, let me back up. What matters is that the error was uncovered during the state's case in chief, but yet the remedy, continued cross-examination, occurred after the defendant waived his right to remain silent, occurred after the defendant rested, and occurred during the rebuttal portion of the phase. We wouldn't be here today, more than likely, had the cross-examination of, I think it was SC, occurred during the state's case in chief, because then the whole argument the defendant doesn't know what the evidence is against him would be gone. Would entirely be gone, because he can make that right, whether or not he's going to testify, remain silent, and other motions that the defense attorneys normally raise at the halftime point.
Are you aware of, you don't cite any Minnesota cases that are directly on point, are you aware of any cases from any other jurisdiction that have found structural error based on the order of cross-examination?
I have not, no.
Thank you.
Am I correct that defense counsel had an opportunity to view the video before the defense case?
You are correct. You are correct. And that's even where it's more paramount that the cross-examination could have been completed prior to the state resting their case.
Could have been, but it wasn't requested. But as far as, at the time defendant elected to testify, he and his counsel knew what the video showed, and they could have foreseen had a plan for cross-examination based on the video.
I would answer sort of. From a defense standpoint, and especially when you're cross-examining a victim in a very horrific criminal sexual conduct allegation, it's nearly impossible to determine what it's actually going to be said. And the way that victims say things to a jury, what they say, all of that goes into determining whether or not defense is going to testify. So I would push back on that notion. Every little thing counts when you're in front of the jury. How she says it, was she going to be crying, what exactly was she going to say, that would all go into the analysis as to whether or not defendant would testify.
I have a question about a rule of evidence, which was not in the briefing, I don't believe, but may have been in the district court's mind at the time, which is 611A. 611 is mode and order of interrogation and presentation. A, control by the court. Court shall exercise reasonable control over the mode and order of interrogating witnesses and presenting evidence for certain purposes. I don't know. Have you thought about whether that rule applies to this situation, and if so, whether that may have been in the district court's mind?
I've thought about it probably within the last 10 seconds, and the answer to that question is that regardless of a citation of that rule, because the court actually did put the completion of the cross-examination during the rebuttal portion of the phase, that would be, I don't think that rule would negate anything. What matters is, was there an error? I argue that there was.
But if it authorizes what the district court did, then there's no error.
Kind of understand the question. What I'm proposing is that cross-examination needs to occur directly after direct examination and before the state arrest. The reason being, the defense will not know what they're up against, essentially. So I think that rule, while I don't have authority because I've only thought about it now within the last minute, would be limited to during the state's case in chief and the defendant's case in chief. And I see that my time is up, so I will take a seat. Thank you.
You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Lisa Lodine. I'm an assistant attorney general. I represent the state of Minnesota as respondent in this matter. We take the position that there is no structural error, that those types of errors are rare and few. This is not such a case. We also take the position that the only type of argument that the defendant or appellant could raise would be a plain error argument, and they clearly cannot establish the four prongs that they would need to establish in order to obtain relief under there. I would like to address some of the facts that I think are essential in responding to the appellant. What hasn't really been discussed through the appellant's argument is how the defense counsel had numerous opportunities to ask for and at least possibly obtain cross-examination of these witnesses before the state rested its case.
How does that affect the structural error analysis? I mean, we're aware of the underlying facts. I think you can assume that.
Okay. So that does not affect the structural error analysis. So I'll go straight to a structural error analysis discussion. So first and foremost, the court obviously knows that structural error is very, very rare, and there's a presumption against applying it. And as you'll note, the appellant in their brief gave citation to several of the cases where it has rarely been invoked, and none of them are similar. They're not analogous. And so if you go out and look, which I did thoroughly, including in federal cases, there is nothing similar to this where structural error has been applied. And that's really because this is not the sort of case where, this is not the sort of situation where the error that they claim occurred affected the case from beginning to end. It's not a categorical type of error that necessarily infected the trial from beginning to end in a way that was fundamentally unfair. As there was discussion at the during appellant's argument, there's often changing around of witnesses due to witness availability. There's often new evidence that comes to light during the middle of trial. There's often, these witnesses may remain under subpoena and be recalled in rebuttal, in which case the parties, if they're brought back up by the state on rebuttal, the defense counsel recrosses them. And so these sorts of situations where evidence, new evidence from witnesses who have already testified comes up on rebuttal, these are not situations that in any case law that I have found have raised structural error in the past. And it does not, I do not believe that appellants have raised any sorts of authority that it would be structural error in the first place.
Can you address appellant's argument that, well, first of all, do you agree that cross-examination should occur of the state's witnesses is typically required to occur before the state rests?
I agree that in the ordinary course of trial proceedings, that is when cross-examination occurs. Do I agree that that is necessarily when it has to occur? No, and that is because the court has authority to adjust the order of proceedings, both under Rule 12 and under the rule of evidence, to accommodate the various problems that occur during trial. The court has to have that authority, that ability to adjust for the presentation of evidence. And while there is a presumption of how it should happen and does happen in the ordinary course, we disagree that that is necessarily what has to happen under any sort of authority or rule or case law.
So based on that, it's your, or what is your view about appellant's argument that the timing of the cross basically affected the defendant's ability or the defendant's decision about whether or not to testify?
Well, it depends in part on whether you're analyzing it under structural error, in which there's an automatic or not, there's no prejudicial analysis, or the plain error analysis. So, I mean,
does that impact on the defendant give rise to a structural error? Not knowing what is going to occur in the cross and having to make a decision about whether to testify prior to that cross, does that
okay, so excluding
error?
The facts of what happened in this case.
No, well, in this case.
I'm just saying a general rule, does a defendant not knowing what would happen My answer to that is no. And the reason why, especially in a case like this, is that the witness is brought back up and examined by the state, and then the defense crosses. So even though, so the defendant theoretically could ask for a surrebuttal so he would get a chance to have that cross-examination and then go back and testify. Now, so he would have that opportunity to confront the second examination on rebuttal of the prosecution witnesses.
Thank you.
So you're saying that when the victim, SC, if I have the initials correct, was recalled or was called again after the defense case, that was essentially a defense surrebuttal case?
No, because that was a cross-examination. So if I recall correctly, If I recall correctly, she was called up and the prosecutor asked a few questions. Is that correct? Okay. So it was a prosecution witness in a rebuttal format. So, and then his questions were in the form of a cross-examination. So when I referred to Sir Rebuttal, my point was he could recall himself and have that opportunity to testify in response to anything that she said about the video. Now, granted, it's not the same as if she testified in full at one time about everything plus the video. But again, so everything happened at one time, and then he presented his defense case with everything happening at one time. His response, that included a response about the video. But as we know, sometimes evidence comes up in the middle of trial, and we don't always have the benefit of being able to respond to everything at the same time. So that's the position that we would take on that. The surrebuttal would be his opportunity to present and that could go beyond him if there was a need presented to the court and the court agreed it was relevant to bring something else up in response to the video.
You made reference earlier to subdivision 12, I think, of rule, 2603. So, I mean, is it your position there was no violation of that rule?
Correct, because if you note, there's no mandates in there. That rule says, you know, the prosecution presents evidence in support of its case, but then it's the defendant may offer its defense, and then the prosecutor may rebut.
I mean, the caption or heading of the subdivision is order of jury trial, and then we have paragraphs A through N, 14 mm-hmm. different stages of trial. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't it implied that they should occur in that order?
Well, the whole point of interpretation of the rules is there's a very strong requirement of being careful about what are mandates, using the words shall, and what are permissives when they use the word may. And so at least the state's position is, you know, the use of the words may here, and as this court obviously pointed out, you know, in the interests of justice, again, the court may allow parties to reopen. So again, this is an opportunity for discretion or, you know, it's not, the order is not mandated. There's an opportunity to adjust it. And so that's the position the state takes in terms of how to interpret subdivision 12. And that, therefore, the way that the order of presentation of witnesses happened in this case is not in violation of subdivision 12. And in fact, you know, the appellant relies on subdivision 12, but doesn't have any authority to suggest that what happened in this case, I mean, he's, you know, very open to pointing out that he doesn't have any authority.
Case law, you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
To show that this type of situation is, in fact, a violation of subdivision 12. So,
and I have a question about how this court should analyze appellant's arguments. I guess appellant's counsel identified three issues, but must we first determine whether the alleged error is structural or not structural, or can we first consider whether the alleged error is an error? And then if we answer that question in the negative, there is no error, must we determine whether the alleged error is structural in nature?
So, Your Honor, in response to that question, I believe it would be appropriate to determine if there's an error. Because if there is no error, it doesn't matter. There's no relevance to it being structural or not. Only if it's an actual error does the type of error determine further analysis. So I agree with Your Honor, or I believe that that's the type of, that first question can be analyzed by the court. And then, I'm sorry, you asked a follow-up question.
Well, there was really one compound question, I think. about whether we must analyze both, when in which order, or whether our answer to one question might make it unnecessary to consider another question.
And I sort of lost track of what that second question was besides.
I think you actually answered it.
Okay.
So, to my satisfaction.
Okay. Well, Your Honor,
I have another question.
Sure.
It has to do with the Supreme Court's Polshinsky opinion.
Sure.
Does it apply to this case?
Absolutely. And as my time runs out, I'd like to just answer that point here on Polshinsky.
You may.
Okay. So Polshinsky gets to that fourth, I call it a prong of plain error, although it's not. So it's that fourth requirement, because it actually applies both to structural errors and plain errors. And that's that requirement that about whether granting a new trial will or won't cause the public to seriously question the fairness and integrity. And the ultimate point for this court that you should, you can decide this on, you can jump to this, just like in Polshinsky, they jump to this factor. There is no basis to conclude that any error in this case would cause the public to seriously question the fairness and integrity. He was allowed to introduce the video. He was allowed a full inquiry of every single witness regarding the video. And he was allowed a chance to testify as to his version of events. So there is no basis to believe, there is no basis for this court to find that the public would seriously question the fairness and the integrity, which is a requirement, even if it is structural error. And we would ask the court to rule in, affirm the conviction, at least on that grounds.
Thank you, Ms. Lodine. Mr. Zeiger, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I will start with the Polzinski decision and the forfeiture doctrine in rebutting Ms. Lodine. Under Brown, I think it was State v. Brown, it stated, structural errors always invalidate a conviction regardless of whether there was an objection. Yet the Polzinski decision may indicate otherwise. In reading that opinion, it's clear that opinion is the statement that objections are necessary to preserve the structural right is unique to that case. Under footnote 9 of that decision, the court itself stated that this opinion or that its analysis is solely due to courtroom closures, which I think makes sense in the era of COVID, jury trials, the protocols of the Minnesota Supreme Court handed down to each of the districts. If the court didn't rule the way that it did, we would be flooded with appeals from courtroom closures that occurred during jury trials during the COVID pandemic. That's not what's at issue here. This is a completely separate issue. And when you look at the element of the forfeiture doctrine, which will allow appellate relief, and look at the elements for structural errors, they're nearly identical with respect to fairness. Both require that fairness, integrity, and reliability be questioned, or fairness and reliability, or fairness and integrity. Essentially, fairness is embedded in both of those. And I'm arguing that it's entirely unfair for this to occur the way that it did.
So you would distinguish Polzinski on that point?
Absolutely, and I think even footnote 9 cited to Justice Strauss of the Minnesota Supreme Court is a statement in a dissent that the question of whether structural errors require objection is not found in Minnesota. That hasn't been addressed yet. But I would cite, I would look to a United States Supreme Court case in Sullivan versus Louisiana. In that case, the court did find a structural error, and it was specifically was a deficient reasonable doubt instruction. I don't have the pin site to it, but I know the court in State v. Brown did cite to it. In that case, I looked at the history in the United States Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and various other mechanisms of how it got to the United States Supreme Court. I could not find an objection anywhere in that case. And the fact that Brown cited that case for the proposition that an objection is not necessary, I think, highlights that. So because this wasn't objected to and may have been acquiesced to the district court trial, I don't think that precludes appellate relief. The last, well, I've got a lot of last things that I want to go over, but one of them is the fact that this error did affect the trial from the beginning to the end. Well, not necessarily, it did not affect opening statements, but structural errors don't necessarily need to affect every single portion of the trial. State v. Mims, it was when a judge went into the jury deliberation room and talked about, hey, you got to get to a verdict at a specific time. That structural error occurred at the end, right? So it's more along the lines of did this error affect the framework from the trial? Not necessarily did it happen from opening statement to verdict, but at some point did it affect? And I'm saying that it did. Had that trial, had cross-examination, complete cross-examination of the video occurred when it was found, that is during before the state rested, we wouldn't be here. But the fact that it happened during the rebuttal portion, that's the issue. And the purpose of rebuttal is not to add evidence to a case. It's to attack what the previous side, what their evidence was. When the state offers rebuttal evidence, it's to rebut what the defense said. It's not to introduce new evidence, which is essentially what this cross-examination of SC did, her testimony regarding the contents of the video. Another last thing that I just want to get to is that these errors are far and few between, and I think Ms. Lodine did a great job of explaining that. That's why I can't find anything. There's no case law that supports that order of cross-examination is, in fact, a structural error. I don't think that's because I wasn't that good of a researcher. I'm sure you guys can find opposite authority to prove me wrong, but I think that this is a very unique set of circumstances. And allowing this order to stand, which would impact every single other trial where defendants wouldn't necessarily have the right to they would have the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, but not in the order that would ensure fairness in their ability to rightfully determine whether they're going to testify or not. Also addressing the point that these kind of issues occurred throughout trial, absolutely. You know, I've been in trials where the last second I get a piece of discovery, and then we have to kind of change the entire analysis. But I'm arguing that when that occurs, it needs to occur during the proper portion in the interest of justice. So in my hypothetical, where the state offers, officer testify to the essential elements, if they then were to call a completely separate witness during the defense's case in chief, I don't know if that would be in the interest of justice because everything the defense put forth at that point, whether or not to remain silent, pretrial motions, would affect what they did. So in the interest of justice, I ask that your honors find the structural error, reverse the conviction, and order a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zeiger. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. That is the final case on today's oral argument calendar, so the court is now adjourned.